Quantum Computing. That's also the name of the paper, which his archive references down here. So you'll find both the main results I'm going to talk about in that paper. All of it's joint work with these seven other guys. And I should mention the Harbron Institute for Mathematical Research at Bristol, who organized the workshop and paid for the workshop where this work was done. So first I ought to tell you what I mean by distributed quantum computing. And I'd like to compare that to the standard circuit model. So let me first just remind you what I mean by the circuit model. So we often design and cost algorithms in the circuit model, which I'm going to call Q circuit for this talk. So what does that mean? What are you allowed to do in the circuit model? Well, you can perform up to, let's suppose we have n qubits. So that means you can perform up to n over 2 qubit gates in each time step. So it's a very highly parallel model. And furthermore, in each time step, there's no restriction on which pairs of qubits can be involved in a gate. So there's also no restriction on connectivity or any locality constraint. So if you were going to build a quantum computer, this is not an incredibly realistic model, because there will be some locality constraints when you try to build the thing in 3D, for example. So the first half of the talk is going to be about a more realistic model called the distributed quantum computer, or the DQC model. So it's not a new idea. It turns out it had also been introduced by Van Meter et al. In 2006-2009. And its main properties are these. So suppose we have many nodes, capital N, many nodes. And each one of these nodes I'm thinking of as a small, well-functioning quantum computer. So it's comprised of, it comprises a small number of qubits, let's say Q. And there's a limited number of connections between the nodes. So not all qubits in all nodes can talk to all other qubits. And exactly which qubits or pairs of qubits can interact is determined by the edges of some graph G, whose nodes are these n nodes here. So the other rule is that I'm going to keep the highly parallel nature of the circuit model. I'm going to say that's fine. You can perform arbitrary 2-qubit gates at each time step, as many as you like, the only restriction being that all of the pairs which interact must be in the same node or in neighboring nodes. Okay, so I'm just restricting the connectivity of the circuit model. So the natural question is, how much weaker is the distributed quantum computing model than the circuit model? So let's fix the number of qubits at each node, Q, and fix a connected graph, G. So the natural question is, how do you run some arbitrary algorithm presented in the circuit model? So the circuit model, in fact, is nothing but the DQC model on the complete graph, right, with no restrictions on which qubits can interact. So given an algorithm whose interactions can lie on the complete graph, how do you run that algorithm on a distributed quantum computer restricted to this graph G with Q qubits per node? And in the first half of the talk, I'll answer that question by giving a recipe which takes any arbitrary circuit in the circuit model on n times Q qubits. And the recipe will output a circuit which performs the same computation, but respects the graph G. So only applies 2-qubit gates across allowed edges in this graph. There's going to be a cost because we're moving to a more restrictive model. So the depth is going to go up by some factor, the depth overhead factor. And I'll show that that's, in fact, almost optimal. So there's a provable lowest bound. And within log factors, we can achieve that bound. And to be slightly more concrete, if the graph G is the hypercube graph, which is a sort of modestly connected graph. If there are n nodes in the hypercube and the valency of each node is just log n, then the distributed quantum computing model can efficiently simulate the circuit model. So I'm going to compare that to much less efficient simulations that are already known. So I think this could be a realistic way of implementing local computation. So let me motivate the ideas by just talking about the 1D nearest neighbor network. Right, so suppose we wish to run a circuit, simulate the circuit model, on the 1D nearest neighbor graph. So in each time step in the circuit model, it's permissible to have order n 2-qubit gates. And furthermore, each of those pair of qubits could be at distance order n apart. So one naive approach to simulating a circuit is to take the first pair of qubits, fix a time slice, take the first pair of qubits, and bring them together using swap gates. Now, the circuits, those qubits could be distance order n apart, so that's order n swap gates to bring them together. Then you can perform the 2-qubit gate locally, and then you can swap them back again. And that whole process is going to take time order n, right? There are order n such 2-qubit gates, so this naive approach is going to take order n squared time just to simulate one time slice of a circuit. So the reason I tell you this approach is because it's not very good and we can do a better one. So in fact, Hirata, Nakashini, Yamashita, and Nakashima had already solved this case. So they showed how to use a sorting network, the insertion sort on the 1D nearest network. Well, I'll explain what that is on the next slide in case you don't know, to in fact do all order n of these gates in time order n. So the problem with this naive approach is that most of the gates are doing nothing most of the time. So it's ripe for parallelization, and that's exactly what Hirata does. Right, so here's an example. Here's a single time slice of an arbitrary circuit on 8 qubits. The only reason these are C-naughts is because they're easy to draw in Q-circuit. So everything I'm going to say works equally well when these are arbitrary 2-qubit gates. And the way to simulate this on a nearest neighbor network is simply to apply a permutation to bring each of these interacting pairs together. So this leftmost gate, I'm going to send the fifth wire to the second position so that I can do this gate locally. The fifth wire is going to the second position. I'm going to send qubits 2 and 8 to positions 3 and 4. It's this permutation here. So I'm just going to bring all my interacting pairs together, perform my 2-qubit gates locally, and then reverse that permutation to get back to where I started. So the question is, how do we compute this permutation here, and what's the cost of doing that? So this is the insertion sort. And in fact, I've written it in a parallel way here, and it's the same as the parallelized bubble sort. So if you haven't seen this before, this is simply a sequence of, or a collection of comparators. Each one of these gates is supposed to represent what's called a comparator. The comparator takes two inputs, two elements from a totally ordered set, and it outputs them in the correct order. So if I labeled these wires on the left by any of the elements, say 1 to 8, and I run them through this sequence of comparators, they'll always come out sorted correctly on the right-hand side. So this is just the classical insertion sort algorithm. So as an example, here's the permutation I wrote down on the previous slide. Well, for any input, they'll get sorted. So in particular, that's true for this input. And furthermore, you can follow the progress of each of these labels as they travel through the network. And some of these gates will perform, will change the ordering, and some will not. I hope you can see this. I'm sorry, you can't do color in Q-circuit yet. So you can record which of the gates here swap the inputs and which ones don't. And that allows you to build a circuit to write down a quantum circuit of swap gates on 8 qubits. So clearly, reading these things as qubits now, I wanted to send this qubit to position 5, and you can see that following through this network, it goes to position 5, and the same is true for all these other gates. Position 6 goes to position 6, and so on. So this implements the permutation that we were interested in. So I'm just going to squidge that up, and you see that's a depth 5 quantum circuit. So in this particular case, it's depth 5. In general, the insertion sort was depth order n. So in general, this is going to be some order n depth circuit. So now I can actually simulate this single time slice here by running the permutation, doing the gates locally, and then reversing the permutation. So you can see that the overhead cost is bounded by twice the cost of a sorting network. So for insertion sort, that's what's order n. OK, so the first result I'd like to tell you about generalizes this to arbitrary graphs. So how do you simulate a circuit on an arbitrary graph? Well, exactly as in the previous case, it comes down to, given a classical permutation, permute qubits according to that permutation. So let's suppose we have n pieces of quantum data, x1 up to xn, and they're stored at the n nodes of a graph. Suppose you've also been handed a permutation, something classically known that you write down at the beginning. And the problem is to implement that permutation on these qubits. In fact, they don't need to be qubits. Each of these pieces of data can be d bits long, but the point is to implement this permutation. So here's the first result. There indeed exists an algorithm for this permutation V of n. It respects the locality of G, so it successfully simulates the circuit model in the distributed quantum computing model on G. And the depth is simply on the order of dG, where dG is the depth of a sorting network over G. I should have had the word connected in here by now. The graph has to be connected for this to work. And there always exists a sorting network on a connected graph. And there always exists a minimal depth sorting network on a graph G. So that's what this dG is going to be, the minimum depth of a sorting network on G. So I'll just formalize the word sorting network that I've been using so far. I already said this, but a comparator is a device which takes two elements as inputs, and it outputs them in the correct order. So the elements have to come from some predetermined, totally ordered set. And then a sorting network is a network built out of comparators with a property that it correctly sorts any inputs taken from this ordered set of T elements. So we've seen the insertion sort as an example already. And later on, I'll need to use the notion of a reversible sorting network. So sorting network's a classical circuit. A comparator is not reversible, right? Because swapping the input doesn't change the output. But you can easily make a comparator reversible just by adding an extra bit for each comparator to record the fact of whether it interchanged the entries or not. So I need that later. So I want to, maybe it's already clear from the insertion sort example how this works for any graph. But I just want to make clear that it works for more interesting sorting networks. So this is the Pitonic sort, which I've drawn on 16 wires. So that's the Pitonic sort on 2 wires, and that's the Pitonic sort on 4 wires, and that's the Pitonic sort on 8 wires. And you can probably write the Pitonic sort down for any number of wires now. And the interesting point is each one of these colored boxes is a depth 1 operation. And you can see that there's one time slice here, 2 here, 3, 4. So the total depth is going to be order log squared n. So there are n inputs, and the depth is only order log squared n. So that's That's much more efficient than the insertion sort, but you'll notice this is obviously not a nearest neighbor. It doesn't respect the nearest neighbor graph. If you look at the top wire, for example, it's connected to the wire 1 below it, 3 below it, 7 below it, 15 below it. It's not too hard to see that this respects the connectivity of a hypercube. So this this sorting network lives on a hypercube. So how do you simulate an arbitrary circuit on the hypercube? Well, here's the 8-bit Bitonic sort. So it's exactly the same technique. Here's a sample permutation we want to render. You record which of these classical gates actually interchange the input and the output. Rewrite them with quantum swap gates. So again, you can see, you know, 6 goes to 6 as it should. And this qubit goes to 4 as it should. This happens to be a depth 4 circuit, but it's certainly bounded above. Its depth is bounded above by the depth of the sorting network on the Bitonic sort. So this is a log n squared depth permutation in general. And just by conjugating our local gates by this permutation, we can simulate one time slice of the circuit model. Okay, so here's the main theorem, which we've hopefully illustrated already. So if G is any connected graph on n nodes, and there are q qubits per node, and I'm going to assume that that's q is just order log n qubits, so a small number of qubits per node, then the DQC model on G can simulate the circuit model, and the cost of doing so, the factor by which the depth increases, is just the cost of a reversible sorting network on G. So I think I already illustrated this. So at each time step, there's a permutation which brings all the interacting qubits together. So you use the data moving algorithm to render that permutation, bring the interacting pairs together. Then you do your 2-qubit unitaries locally. Then you return the qubits by running the quantum data sorting algorithm in reverse. Furthermore, this is pretty much optimal because it's not too difficult to show that the cost of emulating arbitrary circuits of this width, n multiplied by log n, on this fixed graph G is at least the depth of a sorting network, well, divided by some small log factors. So up to log factors, this simulation is optimal. In particular, it also proves that Hirata's algorithm is the optimal way of simulating arbitrary circuits on 1D nearest neighbor networks. Okay, so here's some examples just to illustrate the two extremes. So Hirata's 1D nearest neighbor network with the bubble sort, so the graph has valency 2, right? Every vertex has two neighbors, and the depth of the algorithm is order n, because that's the depth of the insertion sort. Similarly, the 2D nearest neighbor graph also admits an insertion sort. The valency is still constant, and the depth of the sorting network is only root n. The depth of a sorting network is always bounded below by the diameter of the graph, because you may have to sort maximally distant entries. So you couldn't expect to get a sorting network with depth less than order root n for a 2D nearest neighbor graph. This is an interesting example because, as I already said, the hypercube has sort of moderate connectivity, order log n, well, exactly log n valency, but the depth of the Bitonic sort is order log squared n. So this yields an efficient simulation of the circuit model. And in fact, you can do slightly better than that because the hypercube also admits the so-called AKS sort, which actually has a depth of order log n. the reason that this is less popular, I think, is that it's really complicated, and the implied constant here is like 6,000 or something. So it's not something that that you would probably use if you were going to really build a quantum computer in this way. But asymptotically, at least, you can achieve an overhead depth factor of no more than order log n. And just to illustrate the other extreme, the complete graph, of course, has valency order n, and the depth of a sorting network is order log n. Of course, you wouldn't simulate the complete graph on the complete graph, because that would be a pointless thing to do. But just to illustrate the trade-offs here, I think this is a very nice balance. Okay, so I've just spent 20 minutes arguing that the circuit model is too strong. You ought to consider maybe a weaker model of computation if you're really trying to build these things in real life and model real life better. In the second half of the talk, I'm going to argue that the circuit model is not strong enough. It would be convenient in some situations to consider a stronger model of computation. So sometimes it's useful to augment the circuit model by allowing, in addition to all the 2-qubit gates with no restriction on connectivity, by also allowing simultaneous queries to a shared quantum memory, a shared quantum RAM. I'm going to call this the QPRAM, quantum parallel RAM model. And I'll explain exactly what I mean by that, by the operation of simultaneous queries to a shared quantum memory in a couple of slides. So what's the point of this? Well, if you wanted to use Grover's algorithm to search a large database, either of quantum memory or classical memory, which could be addressed in superposition, if you wanted to use Grover's algorithm to search that database, you certainly need to be able to query the database in superposition, at the very least. But what if you wanted to run several Grover searches concurrently? So having many processors running instances of Grover's algorithm, then all processors would be trying to query the same memory at the same time. So there's a question, is that a sensible thing to ask? Is that possible? And the answer is yes. In fact, these two models are equivalent. So we'll show that the circuit model can indeed efficiently simulate the QPRAM model. So I'm going to give an efficient quantum algorithm for doing these parallel memory lookups. And indeed, one of the applications is going to be that we can run parallel Grovers on the same shared quantum memory. And that's going to have some pretty profound effects on high energy search algorithms, high memory search algorithms, like element distinctness, as we'll see at the end. So the remarkable thing about this result is that performing parallel memory lookups are almost exactly the same cost as performing a single memory lookup. So there's a sense in which any circuit which is capable of querying a large quantum memory, it's not working very hard. Because you can look up an enormous number, you can query an enormous number of memory sites simultaneously. So I'll explain this as we go along. So let me just explain what I mean by memory lookup. Suppose we want to look up a single piece of quantum data in this list. So I've got some, let's say, d-bit long pieces of quantum data saved somewhere on my quantum computer, and I want to perform the following unitary map. So here's my data written into quantum memory, and here's y, the state of my computer, the sort of state of the current computation. So the computer has some index or some address and it wishes to look up the jth piece of data, and so it does that by somehow pulling out the jth piece of data and XORing it into the second register. That's what I mean by a memory lookup. In the circuit model, there's some obvious lower bounds for this. Any circuit that performs this unit tree here requires width at least n times d, simply because that's the size of this register that records the quantum data. And it requires depth at least log n, because you need depth log n circuitry. This j could be one of any n inputs, and so to be able to reach any of these memory locations, you need at least depth log n circuitry. So let's move to the parallel memory lookup case. So suppose we want to look up n pieces of data in parallel. I think the most convenient way to think of this operation is in the language of the distributed quantum computing model. So in that case, you have many small quantum processors connected by some graph. So I want to think of this memory as being distributed across the different processors. So each of these xi belongs to some processor I. And the current state of computation, if you like, on processor I is this yi. And processor I also has some index ji, which addresses the piece of data it would like to look up. And so this unitary map here is simply each of the processors calling up the data it's interested in. Right? Processor I looks up the piece of data x sub j sub I and XORs it into its second register. So that's what I mean by a parallel memory lookup. So the result is that there indeed exists a circuit for this, what I'm calling UNN, this parallel memory lookup algorithm, and the width is a little bit worse than n times d, and the depth is a little bit worse than log n. So up to these extra log factors here, this is almost optimal. It almost reaches the lower bounds from the previous slide. Right, so before I show you that slide, I'm going to show you the circuit for UNN, or at least the algorithm for building it. The notation is a little bit daunting, but I find that thinking of everything in the distributed quantum computing model of many processors all doing their little thing should hopefully make clear what's going on. So the first thing I'm going to do is to take the input data as it was given to me and just rearrange it. So this isn't really a computation. This is just writing the Hilbert space in a different way that's going to serve as some way of making it easier to understand what's happening. So here are my n processors, or the n nodes in my DQC model. And each processor has a Hilbert space containing a vector that looks like this. So I'm going to call these two kets packets. So it has two packets. Each processor has two packets. The ith processor has an answer packet and a question packet. This A and Q is just a single bit flag that labels whether it's an answer or a question. And the answer packet on processor I says, I live at processor I, and I contain the data XI. The question packet on processor I says, I'd really like to get hold of the data X sub J sub I, the data addressed by this index here, and here's where I'd like to write it. So the key is to run these packets through a sorting network. So you'll remember in the first half, I wrote down a classical sorting network, and I said that by appending a bit to each comparator, you could make the sorting network reversible. So there's a classical reversible algorithm. I'm just going to think of that as a quantum algorithm. So I'm feeding into a sorting network these packets, and I'm going to declare that I'm only sorting by the first two registers. So just to go back a slide, the sorting network is only going to see the labels AI and the Q sub I, sorry, J sub I, Q. So the upshot is that these packets are all going to get shuffled around the computer, but they're going to end up in the correct order. So this is implementing some permutation here. This is just to indicate, this is supposed to indicate all those extra bits added to the comparators have to be recorded somewhere. So I'm just shoving them in this ket here. And I've now got all my packets in the correct order. So what does that actually look like? Oh yeah, sorry. And the depth, of course, is just the depth of the sorting network. So I've just run a sorting network. So what's the state of the computer at this point? Well, wherever this packet is, the answer packet from processor I, it won't be at processor I anymore, it'll be somewhere else. But wherever it is, immediately to the left of it is going to be all of the question packets that queried processor I, because I've just sorted on these first two registers. So it could be that no processors queried processor I, in which case the number of these things is zero, or it could be at the other extreme that every single processor queried processor I, in which case there are capital N of these. But whatever it is, they're all immediately left of the answer packet which contains the data they're looking for. So now that that's true, now that the question packets are sort of within spitting distance of the answer packets they've been seeking, we can cascade this data, this XI, leftward. And the details are a bit finickety, but the important thing is that we can copy this data, XI, leftwards into the empty data register, this fourth register here, simply by performing controlled knots on this first register, sorry, on this fourth register to the target fourth register. And you first do that at distance one. So copy the XI one position left. And then you cascade those two values distance two. And then you cascade those four values distance four. And in that way, you could cascade this data capital N steps to the left in just order log N time steps. So once you've done that, the sequence of packets has just had the requested data XI copied leftwards. Right, so at this point, there's a simple step. Every packet simply copies the memory data in the fourth register into the third register. This isn't very exciting, it's a depth one operation, but it does mean that this is what we were trying to achieve at the beginning. The packet which had queried processor I has XORed in the data X sub I that it was looking for. So we're almost there. We just have to uncompute everything and tidy up all the ancillas we used. So the first step is to uncascade. So just reverse whatever circuitry you did to do the cascade to clean out these fourth registers here. So all the data registers are sort of localized back to the answer packets. And so the total result of the previous three steps, cascade, copy, and uncascade, is to take each question packet of this form and copy in the requested data to the third register. And the effect on the answer packets is simply to have put a copy of the data into the third register. Okay, so we're nearly there. All we have to do is unsort. So whatever circuit you run to sort them through the sorting network, you run that in reverse. And since we haven't done anything to the first two registers, we haven't touched anything here. All the computation happened in the third and fourth registers. The effect of running through the sorting network in reverse is exactly to put the states back into the order they were originally in, which is this order here. So now my answer packets simply copied the data, and my question packets received the data it's requested. And the final step is just to forget about the distributed quantum computing picture and bug everything back into a big old ket. So the only complication, I mean, this I and the A and the Q are all classically known at compile time. So you can just sort those out using Pauli X gates and just delete them. And the QIs and this register here and the XIs can be all swapped out into these original kets. And there's an extra time step to just relocalize the XI because we copied it. So we'll just uncopy the XI. So that's a depth two. It's not really a computation. It's just rearranging the way we're thinking of the Hilbert space. And that's it. So the this is the final state that we were looking for. So we've successfully implemented a parallel memory lookup. I did note the depth on each of these slides. The only one that mattered was the depth of the sorting network. So this all happens in order, the depth of the sorting network depth. Right, so what was the point of all that? Well, our motivation for looking at this in the first place was wondering whether you could Grover search a database in parallel. So that's the first application I'd like to tell you about. I'm sure you all know this with your eyes shut, but let me just remind you what Grover's search algorithm does. So Grover's search algorithm solves the equation f of j equals 1, where f is some function from some set, let's say 1 up to capital N, and its output is a single bit. So one way of looking at this is that it performs a search through this set from 1 to N, and the only tool it needs, apart from some simple polynomial time circuitry that implements a reflection, is this unitary map. So this unitary instantiation of the function f. So I'm sure you've all seen this before. So suppose instead of performing the usual Grover search algorithm, we really want to search a database instead. So now I'm going to consider a function alpha, which takes values in some database, xj indexed by j running from 1 to n. So I want to solve the equation alpha of xj equals 1. So which element of the database does alpha mark as being the hidden element? Right, so I'm now looking for an index to an element of a database. And that's not hard to do. So I don't know if it was worth spelling this out, but you can construct the Grover oracle simply by conjugating the unitary instantiation of the function alpha that you're familiar with from the usual Grover search by the single memory lookup algorithm. So just to make that clear, here's the large quantum database written into memory. Here's the current state of the computation. Here's an index. The single memory lookup pulls out the jth piece of data. Function alpha evaluates alpha on this piece of data and XORs it in here. And then calling the single memory lookup again cleans this register. And the overall effect, of course, is that these first and third registers implement exactly the Grover oracle. Okay, so now you can perform the Grover search. I have to make things a bit more complicated so that the applications to this application work. So I'm just going to replace my function alpha with a function which takes in R tuples from a database. So now I'm looking for a multi-index, which indexes R database entries which are marked by alpha. And in just the same way, you can construct an oracle the Grover oracle by conjugating you have to use the single memory lookup R times, but that's straightforward. So what's the cost of this Grover's algorithm? Well, the width has got to be at least nd, because that's the size of the quantum database. So obviously we need at least that much space. And the depth, I don't know if I should have written this out in full. Here's the depth of this oracle here. And here's the number of times you run Grover's algorithm. So the search space is size n to the r, because you're searching a database of size n and you're looking at r tuples, and m is the number of solutions. So this is the standard costing of Grover's algorithm. The only important thing to take away, it really, is square root of n to the r. Okay, so let's ask about what I'm going to call the multi-Grover search algorithm. So now suppose that we've got n separate functions. They can be distinct, they don't have to be the same thing, but I've got n functions of the right type to run Grover's algorithm. So each one of them returns a bit 0 or 1 when you input our database elements. So as before, the database contains these n data strings, and I'm going to assume that their length is relatively small, so just polylog n. And then the result is that there's a quantum algorithm that returns all n solutions. So it runs a Grover's algorithm on all n of these functions here and correctly finds a solution if there's one to find. And its width is slightly worse than n, and its depth is slightly worse than this function here. I'm hiding log factors in the tilde notation there. So these are exactly, I mean, up to the tildes, these are exactly the costs of the lower bound for running a single Grover's algorithm on this database. So for just logarithmically cost, for logarithmic increase in the cost, we can actually solve n separate instances of the Grover algorithm. So as you might expect, that has consequences, and so we can improve pretty much any algorithm that involves a search over some large quantum memory. So the two examples I've chosen are the element distinctness algorithm and the collision problem. So I'll just outline these algorithms quickly. So element distinctness is the following problem. You're given a function which maps n bits to n bits, and the decision problem is to determine whether f is injective or not. So you can treat this as a query problem, or you can cost things in terms of space and time, s and t here. I'm not so interested in queries, so I'm going to assume from now on that the circuitry for little f is very small, just polylog n in width and depth. So classically, it turns out that one way to solve this is just to look at all pairs of inputs and see if they give the same output. So that's a search over a space of size n squared. Capital N is 2 to the little n here. So it turns out that you're free classically to trade off space and time as long as you end up doing the same amount of work. Is this electronic? This thing. Is that enough to see? Okay, so I've plotted st equals order n squared here. It's this top white line. This is the classical space versus time trade-off for the element distinctness problem. So Ambanis has a really nice quantum walk algorithm for solving the element distinctness problem. And he certainly improves the query complexity. And if you go through his algorithm, you'll find that he achieves space-time trade-off of space equals time is on the order of n to the 2/3. So that's this pink dot here. This is the Ambanis algorithm, which is clearly better than classical. Now, it turns out that if you're not concerned about query complexity, but you're more concerned about space and time trade-offs, you can actually achieve and Baynes's space-time trade-off and generalize it further just by doing a naive standard Grover search. So simply divide the search space up into sides, into S pieces of size n squared over S, and run a Grover search on each one. The time is the square root of this thing, n over root S. And so the space-time trade-off is ST squared is order n squared. So simply by using the standard Grover algorithm, you can trade off space and time according to this dashed line here. Is that visible? Yeah.
So that still uses O of n inquiries. Or maybe more.
What does it do? So each of these S blocks will use n over root S queries.
Right, so you actually it's O of n times root S
queries. Yes, correct. Yeah, so I don't remember if Ambanus proves that his algorithm is optimal in terms of query complexity, but I'm certainly not claiming an improvement in query complexity. So taking the Berman Duo Heiligman Hoyer Magnier Santer de Wolf algorithm for element distinctness, and simply replacing their Grover searches with multi-Grover searches, we can actually achieve a better trade-off. Space times time is order n. So that's this lowest curve here. I can maybe run through the details of that at the end if anyone's interested. But it takes a known algorithm and replaces Grover search with multi-Grover search. So this is moderately important because almost 10 years ago, Grover and Rudolph asked how significant are the known collision and element distinctness algorithms. And they hypothesized that this space-time trade-off that was known back then maybe ought to be improvable, bettered. So in particular, our multi-Grover algorithm answers this challenge posed by Grover and Rudolph. So the other problem I was going to mention is the collision problem. Collision problem, you're given a function of the same type. It's n bits to n bits, and it comes with a promise that f is either 1-to-1 or 2-to-1, and it's your job to determine which. The best previously known quantum algorithm by Brassard, Hoyer, and Tapp gives space-time time equals n to the 2/3. But in fact, we can just replace their Grover search with multi-Grover search once more, and the trade-off drops to space times time is root n. Or another way of looking at it is if you pick, so capital N is 2 to the little n, as before. If you pick square root n elements at random in here and run the element distinctness algorithm on them, that will answer the collision problem. So you can simply use the element distinctness algorithm as a subroutine. And it also achieves this trade-off here. So once again, that answers the challenge of Grover-Rudolph.
But this time, you're not changing the query complexity when you do that.
Changing the
query complexity is staying the same. Right? Because it's basically just a Grover's algorithm. I mean, the old Broussard algorithms.
Right. I think we're just parallelizing the same algorithm, essentially. Yeah, right. Okay, so to conclude, if you put the two halves of this talk together, then we showed that the distributed quantum computer can simulate the circuit model, and the circuit model can simulate the Q-prime model. So you can put those together, and you get this sentence here. And furthermore, if you choose G to be a hypercube, then this simulation is efficient. There's a total cost of no more than log squared n. And as a consequence, if you were to build a quantum computer, you could do so by distributing quantum memory amongst many processors and just joining those processors by a moderate number of long-range qubits. And finally, as an application of the parallel memory lookup algorithm, we can meet the Grover-Rudolph challenge and improve space-time trade-offs for these two algorithms, element distinctness and the collision problem, and in general, it speed up more or less any algorithm which uses a search over a large space database. But if you've got any questions, please fire away.
Questions, then let's thank the speaker again.